Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Afghanistan was in political news this week as President Obama traveled there in a surprise visit that included the announcement of an agreement with leaders there and presented more fodder for his Republican foes. Everything he does that. Some question, for example, whether taking out Osama bin Laden a year ago was really that big of a deal. And to that, the president responded thusly.
I just recommend that everybody take a look at people's previous statements in terms of whether they thought it was appropriate to go into Pakistan and take out bin Laden. I assume that people meant what they said when they said it. That's been at least my practice. I said that I'd go after bin Laden if we had a clear shot at him, and I did.
Still, Senator John McCain, Obama's opponent in the last presidential election, questioned whether the president deserved to take the credit at all.
Any president, Jimmy Carter, anybody, any president would have obviously, under those circumstances, done the same thing. And to now take credit for something that any president would do is indicative of the kind of campaign we're under, we're seeing.
Joining us now to talk about what kind of campaign we're seeing and whatnot is NPR's political editor, political junkie, Ken Rudin. Welcome, Ken.
Good morning, Ann.
Question for our listeners. Do you think the president's handling of the war in Afghanistan and the mission to kill bin Laden are fair political game? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or go to our Facebook page. So, Ken, is a war, any war, its progress, typically fair political capital for a sitting president?
Well, of course it is. I mean, whether it's going well or not, that's for the American people to decide, and that's what determines elections. Lyndon Johnson got out of the race in 68 because the Vietnam War was not going well. If wars are going well, presidents do and should take credit, and when they're not going well, they should take credit, should take blame as well. They don't always do.
So what do you make of John McCain's comment, some of response, you know, which has elicited its own criticism? Some have responded that he based an entire career on doing something any POW would have done, try to survive.
Well, wow. I mean, it gets worse and worse. Well, if you say this, what about this?
Right.
Well, look, I mean, and Rudy Giuliani got criticism for the longest time. I think it was Joe Biden who said that Rudy Giuliani, the only thing he could say is a noun, a verb, and 9/11. That's the only thing he has to say.
Right.
Because Rudy Giuliani talked about what his stewardship of New York City after the tragic events of September 11th. So, sure, you know, it's a legitimate issue. But I think part of it is also that the American people know that that the war is not going well. And I think Obama recognizes it, too. And that's why we're talking about deadlines to get out. But I mean, just the mention of Jimmy Carter is obviously a design. Maybe it's a red flag to wave in front of Republicans saying that this guy is still, you know, in over his head with foreign policy. Now, of course, the Obama camp and the White House will disagree, saying that President Bush tried for years to get Osama bin Laden, did not, and we, the Obama administration, did.
You know, speaking of previous presidents, the role of Bill Clinton in the Obama strategy has been popping up lately.
So. Well, that's not a surprise. I mean, Bill Clinton still remains extremely popular with the Democratic base. Do they have their differences in 2008? Well, of course, Clinton's wife was running against him, so that's not a surprise. There were a lot of snide comments between the Obama and Clinton camps in 2008. But, I mean, I think mostly everybody agrees that Hillary Clinton is doing a tremendous job as Secretary of State, although that may be put into question given what's going on right now in China, and that's, you know, also too soon to tell, but that could blow up in the Obama administration's face too. But President Clinton, despite all the shenanigans, despite all the personal foibles, remains very popular, and why not have somebody like him on the stump with the president?
Well, what would it be that's at a primary level with the base, but could it hurt him in the general?
Well, that's, you know, something that's what Al Gore wrestled with in 2000, whether to embrace.
Right.
Of course, it was much more recent and Bill Clinton was more in the news then. But Al Gore could decide whether it excites the base or turns off independents. I think the mood about Bill Clinton has mellowed over the years. And I think he's not as poisonous with the so-called independent vote that he may have been 10, 12 years ago.
If you're just joining us, it's All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And my guest right now, Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. What do you think? is a warfare fodder in a political campaign. And what else do you want to talk about? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Al in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. Hi, Al.
Hey. Yeah, hi. This is Al. And my comment is that had Osama bin Laden not been captured during Obama's term in office, now that we're in the presidential election, he would be hammered completely for doing very little to have captured him. And the fact that he did make the decision during that compound, he should also receive the credit, because if Osama bin Laden was still outstanding, he would be getting hammered right now by the Republican Party for not doing much to capture him, especially since we're still in the Afghanistan war. So those are my comments.
Okay.
That's absolutely true, and I think everybody agrees with that. Remember when Bush, the charge that John Kerry made about President Bush back in 2004 was that the United States had Osama bin Laden at Tora Bora or whatever in Afghanistan, and we let him go. So just as the Democrats went after Bush for not getting Osama during Bush's term in office, of course the Republicans would go after Obama had he not gotten it. And so you know, it's almost strange that the Republicans almost wish that that they didn't get him because they lose an issue. But I mean, I don't really mean that literally. But you know, when gasoline prices were hiking up in 2006, all the Democrats were gleefully pointing to the increase in gas prices outside the service stations, just as Republicans are doing now. Now, do the party out of power want gas prices to go up? Do the Republicans not want Osama bin Laden to be caught? Of course not. But again, when we're talking about politics, you know, strange decisions are being made.
Thank you, Al, for the call.
Okay, thank you.
The absolute latest news, which is impossible to know, but Newt Gingrich suspends his campaign. Let's listen.
Today, I'm suspending the campaign. But suspending the campaign does not mean suspending citizenship. Calista and I are committed to be active citizens. We owe it to America. We owe it to Maggie and Robert. In my case, I've been an active citizen since August of 1958.
I don't know what happened. In August 1958, I don't know.
You know something? I heard that and I had no idea what that meant. I've been an active citizen since 1958. Well,
that means the first year he voted.
No, he's not that old. But and then you had to be 21.
Well, that's the thing is, now he makes me think he's older than he actually is. When he said, "What?"
The fact that we're still talking about Newt Gingrich is ultimate Gingrich. credited Newt Gingrich.
Yeah.
Look, not too many months ago, Newt Gingrich was convinced, and he told everybody he was convinced that he would be the nominee. And many pundits were convinced as well that, you know, he's a front runner, which, again, I've been on your show a long time, and I've always said, would you stop with the front runner stuff before people start voting? Once people start voting, then we'll see who front runners are. And once people started voting, aside from South Carolina and Georgia, Newt Gingrich, you know, they weren't buying Newt Gingrich. But, you know, not too long ago, he was talking about the presidency. About a month ago, he was talking about he's going all the way to the convention in Tampa, mm-hmm. and now he's a citizen.
An active citizen. Don't take that away from him. So, all right, so what happens now? It's everybody out of the pool but Mitt Romney and, I guess, Ron Paul.
Well, Ron Paul, actually, there's a lot of stuff behind, under the blanket of secrecy, but the Ron Paul people are still very active. Even though there are caucuses and primaries in the early stages of these states, in later states, in state and county conventions and state conventions, actual delegates to Tampa being picked. And Ron Paul is actually picking up some delegates and winning over some converts. And, you know, right now it looks like it's going to be a boring coronation for Romney in Tampa. But if Ron Paul continues to gain stuff under the surface, it could be an interesting story. But really, this nomination is sewn up.
Travis in Newark, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Travis.
Yeah, thank you. I just wonder, George Bush, probably two-thirds of his presidency, you know, made a big deal about getting Osama and ending al-Qaeda and everything else, and that's what he dedicated so much of his presidency to, and now Obama actually succeeded in that, and they're giving him crap for taking credit for it when he's the commander-in-chief and that's his role. So he should very much get credit for it. So I just don't understand why he's taking so much grief for taking credit for that.
Well, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, how could you not take credit for it? I mean, and first of all, it's understandable that President Bush spent so much of his administration trying to get Osama. I mean, because 9/11 happened under his watch, and I'm not blaming George W. Bush, but look, I don't have to tell you what a traumatic event it was, not only for the government, but for every American. And Osama's capture was you know, something that had to be done, and the Bush administration knew it. The fact that Obama did it and did it successfully, I think Mitt Romney almost was biting his lip, but he had the right pose the other day when Obama was in Afghanistan and Romney said that, look, you know, with the American people, I'm glad he's there. I'm glad he's addressing the mission. A lot of Americans want to know the status of what's going on there, and it's good that he's doing that. Look, you know, and we all know that whatever Obama does is going to be criticized by the Republican Party, just as almost everything that Bush did was attacked and criticized by the Democratic Party. That's the name of the game. But sometimes there are things where, by any objective standard, it's an absolute success, and I can't see the argument against. I can't see the argument against getting Osama bin Laden. But here's something interesting: the Democrats went ballistic at the Bush administration for the waterboarding and the torture of, what, 3, 4, 5 people, whatever it is, in Guantanamo and the suspected terrorists. But the left is surprisingly quiet when the Obama administration will send drones into Pakistan killing, what, 1,500 people. Is torture more, objectionable than outright killing? I mean, so there's so many questions here, and it depends on what side you're on, but it's just very interesting that both sides are not seeing this the same way.
Thanks, Travis.
That was a very long sentence, wasn't it? I'm sorry.
I think you had several sentences in there. No, you had some periods. You talked about a subjective list of the top 5 VP vice presidential picks of the past half century, and I was wondering, would Ohio Senator Rob Portman, one of the latest Prince Charmings in the vice presidential pageant, make that cut?
Well, first of all, let's be honest. I mean, for all the focus on vice presidential running mate picks that the political media and I guess some part of the American public pay attention to in the next couple of months, ultimately it's not that important. I mean, it does say a lot about the president's judgment. Just like, you know, John McCain picking Sarah Palin, there was a brief shining moment where it was a brilliant pick, and then for the rest of the year, and perhaps for the rest of the last 4 years, everybody was saying, what the heck was John McCain thinking? And how could you just put somebody that close, you know, heartbeat away from the presidency? But ultimately, aside from like Lyndon Johnson in 1960, who was my top pick for the best running mate in history, because even though Kennedy and Johnson didn't like each other, and we knew that Bobby Kennedy and Johnson hated each other, Johnson helped carry a lot of states for Kennedy's election in 1960, and perhaps got him elected president. So, but for the most part, you know, you think of Geraldine Ferraro. Wow, what a great pick! The women were so excited. Oh my goodness, it's the greatest thing in history. And Mondale Ferraro lost 49 out of 50 states. I'm not blaming Geraldine Ferraro, but a lot of times we say, oh, this is going to really be a game changer, and it ultimately is not. Rob Portman, by even Rob Portman standards, is not going to be a game changer, but he's solid, and he may be boring, but he's a solid guy. Now, there are criticisms against him that, you know, if he was the budget director under President Bush and the economy started to tank under President Bush, should he take the blame? I mean, since we're blaming people, we might as well blame Rob Portman as well. So that's up there too. But if you want somebody solid and somebody serious, somebody who could certainly take over at a moment's notice, and by the way, Ohio is a pretty important state, why not Rob Portman?
My guest is Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. If you have a question or comment for Ken, we welcome them. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org, and you can go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page, and you can tweet me at Ann Fisher WOSU. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, John Edwards on trial, accused of using nearly $1 million in campaign funds to hide an affair. Is he a cad or a criminal? Should he be facing up to 30 years in jail? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point is this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. Warming up quite nicely today, 77 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine throughout the day, and a high of 87 degrees. Partly cloudy for tonight, a low of 64. There is a chance of a shower, maybe a thunderstorm on Friday, a high of 81 degrees. Expect some rain Friday night, a low of 61, and then sunshine on Saturday and a nice day with a high of 78. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
The youth vote rears its youthful head in the presidential campaign. The president, who will officially kick off his campaign at Ohio State University this weekend, takes his pitch to the late-night television circuit, slow jamming on student loans with Jimmy Fallon.
That means some hardworking students will be paying about $1,000 extra just to get their education. So I've called on Congress to prevent this from happening. What we said is simple. Now is not the time to make school more expensive for our young people.
Oh, yeah. You should listen to the president. Or as I like to call him, the Preezy of the United Steezy.
Presumptive GOP candidate Mitt Romney makes sure everyone knows he cares too.
I fully support the effort to extend the low interest rate on student loans. There was some concern that that would expire halfway through the year, and I support extending the temporary relief on interest rates for students as a result of student loans, obviously, in part because of the extraordinarily poor conditions in the job market.
So, what works with the youth are both trying to woo here, although, by the way, these loan rates affect the pocketbooks of a lot of parents, too. I'm not sure one works with both.
Yes, that's true. But, of course, I mean, the youth vote, there's several things at stake here. First of all, we know that the youth vote, as in many communities in the United States in 2008, were very, very excited about Barack Obama's candidacy. And that's unusual in the history of this country. I mean, for the most part, I mean, when they lowered the voting age to 18 in 1972, I mean, you thought that George McGovern would get a tremendous amount of young people, but it didn't really help him much. A lot of young people turned out for Bill Clinton, even Ross Perot. But most people, most of the time, young people don't vote. They did vote in 2008. It did help Obama, and obviously Obama wants to recreate that magic for 2012. But he's also very aware that, you know, if we're talking about an 8.3% unemployment rate, well, for those, you know, kids who are between 20 and 24 years old thereabouts, their unemployment rates are 13, 14%. So the last thing he wants is a disaffected young base compared to what he had in 2008. And obviously both candidates realize that in a close election, which 2012 could certainly be, a block like young voters, not that they always vote in a block, but a block like young voters could be very significant.
There were criticisms, though, that going on Jimmy Fallon didn't really hit that many people. It was a small group, really, 100,000 there. I have no idea what the numbers are on Jimmy Fallon.
First of all, I mean, I watched that bit, and I mean, maybe it's because I'm near the end of my life, but I didn't think it was funny at all. But, you know, I mean, how many people saw Bill Clinton or in Arsenio Hall? I don't think, you know, when he played the saxophone that time in 1992, I don't think that many people saw it, but a lot of people talk about it afterwards. And in this era of viral news, all you have to do is appear one place, and you could see the clips about it multi times afterwards. So I don't think it matters how many people saw it live, but at least a lot of people know about it now. I think although Mitt Romney is trying to try to get equal footing, he's going to appear on Jack Parr tonight, which I thought that would be good. Yeah.
And you got to be as old as Ken to know who that is.
Ow.
Mark in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Yeah, thanks very much. First, a comment that, Ken, you will live forever in our hearts, so don't worry about it.
He's writing, Mark's writing my obituary already.
Right.
Unbelievable.
That's right. Well, you asked the New York Times whether they have your obituary ready for you. I hope not.
Yeah.
The question I wanted to ask was your thoughts on the U.S. Senate race in Ohio between Sherrod Brown and Josh Mandel. It's really only just heating up. Josh has hit the airwaves with a lot of positive ads. Sherrod's hit the airwaves with a lot of negative ads, but there's a lot of activity going on. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm surprised that Brown is going as negative as he is, because I think he's a better candidate. I mean, I don't know if Josh Mandel is the best candidate the Republicans could come up with, but he's obviously the nominee, and he cleared the field a long, long time ago, and he has a ton of money to spend on his behalf. Look, we know that Ohio is going to be one of the top three or four or maybe two top presidential states in November, and obviously anything that where the Republican Party is putting a lot of money in could certainly help Mandel. But, you know, it's early. I just don't see Mandel winning the race. I just think that, you know, there are a lot of Democrats who are vulnerable. We could talk about Claire McCaskill in Missouri and John Tester in Montana and things like that. But I just don't think Sherrod Brown gets defeated.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thanks, Mark. If you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513. My guest this hour is Ken Rudin,
the late Ken Rudin,
or soon to be late Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. We have an email from Debbie regarding a former U.S. senator regarding the John Edwards case. She asks, if the charges are true, is it Riel Hunter? Riel Hunter accepted a boatload of illegal payments for her silence. Why then is she not charged with any crime?
Well, if the money went to, if John Edwards, I mean, this is the thing. Look, if he's an abhorrent figure, we know that. If he's a cad, we understand that. But if he broke campaign finance laws, that's John Edwards. I mean, that's what we're talking about, not Riel Hunter. Then what about the people who gave the money to that would go to Riel Hunter to silence her? So, I mean, they although both of them. One of them, Fred Barron, is deceased, and the other one is the elderly woman in North Carolina. But anyway, it's about taking money, getting money, and using it to buy somebody's silence. And if that was done with that knowledge, I don't know what the case is proving, but if it's done with that knowledge, I mean, 30 years in prison seems to be a long time in prison for something like that. But the more the trial goes on. At first it was about Andrew Young, the former Edwards aide who, you know, said that he was the father of Riel Hunter's baby and all that stuff. And it was looking that Andrew Young was the real jerk in this whole thing. But the more we hear, the more how, you know, especially from Andrew Young's wife and then yesterday former Elizabeth Edwards aide, the more we hear about how John Edwards tried to, you know, to get away with everything. It's just so despicable. Again, do you go to jail for 30 years? Do you pay $1.8 million in fines? I don't know. But the thought is that John Edwards was not only – he was running for president, and then he was angling for vice president as his out-of-wedlock child was being born. Mm-hmm. I mean, what if he was on the ticket, and this is October 2008, and then the Inquirer breaks the story? I mean, as reckless as he was with his own life, as cruel as he was to his wife, who was dying of cancer, he could have brought the entire party down as well. I mean, not that that's any worse than what else he's done, but it's just despicable in so many ways. And that's how I feel.
Rick in Grandview, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Rick.
Hi, thank you. Sorry to take it back to business with Obama.
Well, I asked, so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to mention a few things that came up during Bush's administration. I thought it was a long PR program from the Bush administration with terms like war president, war on terror, mission accomplished. And what really disgusted me back then was that he would have speeches where he used young recruits as a backdrop. Obama doesn't do that. He goes out on the field and talks to the guys that are there. And then famously Bush said, I don't care about Osama bin Laden.
I'm not familiar with that quote. I mean, I understand look, I mean, we know, we can go back to certainly the Nixon administration about using war as a backdrop and using patriotic symbols and PR slogans, and I understand that. But, I mean, to say that he didn't care about Osama, I'm not familiar with that quote, but I am certainly, as an earlier call mentioned, I mean, he was obsessed with him, and, you know, he probably did things that he ordinarily would have not have done, you know, above board. But he just wanted Osama gone, and he did what he could. Of course, he didn't go all the way like Obama did. But I don't think we want to compare. You know, but both. I'm sorry, I'm not too coherent here. But both sides want to, of course, dress up their record and to say that Obama's doing it less than, you know, Bush. Well, I mean, you could also say that Obama is going to more swing states to make so-called non-political speeches than any president in history. And he doesn't even have any opposition in the primary. So, I mean, look, the object is to get reelected. There are some people, you know, who say, look, I'm here for one term and I'm going to do my damnedest and then get out. But everybody's running for reelection. Everybody's trying to make their case as attractive as ever. Whether Obama was as overt about it as Bush, you could argue that, but both sides do that.
Thank you, Rick, for the call. Appreciate it. So, you know, there was a tiff here. Well, it's more than a tiff, really, because it's got a little bit of legs, about a Cub Scout den mother who was kicked off the job by one of the councils of the Boy Scouts of America because she's gay. And Mitt Romney is on the record. That's circulating now, at least in Ohio, his comments that all people should be able to participate in the Boy Scouts, regardless of sexual orientation. That's in Ohio. Across the country, you're saying that's the way it is for him. That's part of his problem.
Well, yeah. I mean, the problem is which Mitt Romney are we talking about? Once upon a time, and I've said this on your show many, many times, that once upon a time when he was running for the Senate against Ted Kennedy in 1994, he said some things that he probably would not say today about gay rights, about choice, about same-sex marriage, about stem cell research, and he, you know, in many ways, he was almost trying to outbid Ted Kennedy with groups, you know, with pro-gay marriage and pro-abortion groups, interest groups. Now, of course, running for president, you try to forget those lines, but that's the difficulty Mitt Romney will have in running to the center in November in the general election, because all year long, the Gingriches and the Santorums of the world were saying that he's truly a moderate at heart, that he's only become a fire-breathing conservative because he's running for the nomination. And so that's the problem that Romney has. And another problem he has, Richard Grenell, his foreign policy and national security aide, who was openly gay, was forced out the other day because, well, one, because he's openly gay and so-called pro-family groups don't like that. But also, he made some major mistakes, this aide did, by tweeting about Newt Gingrich. It's like snarky tweets about Hillary Clinton's looks and Rachel Maddow's looks and Calista mm-hmm. Gingrich's looks. So, but I mean, the issue about gay rights and you think would be settled in the Republican Party. But as with many things that Mitt Romney has said in the past, there is a tortured aspect to it, you know, a conflicting aspect to it, that he's going to have to deal with all the way until November 6th.
Okay, so let's look at what's coming up. You predicted May 1st Newt Gingrich would officially suspend his campaign. You were off by a day, not bad. On May 8th, you've predicted...
I didn't predict that he was a true citizen in April of 1958.
It's 1958.
What was that? I don't know what that is.
I'll have to research that more and find out what he means.
I'll get back to you.
You also predicted that May 8th, there's primaries in Indiana, North Carolina.
There are 31 days in May. I predicted that as well. Yes.
Talk about, do these matter?
Oh, they do. Well, they may not matter on the presidential side, but again, there's a huge primary next Tuesday, May 8th in Indiana, where Richard Lugar, who's been in the Senate since he was first elected in 1976, is being challenged by the Tea Party because he's President Obama's favorite Republican, that he's, you know, he's talks more to Democrats than he does to conservative Republicans. But it's even more than that. Lugar has not been in the state. He, matter of fact, when he goes to Indiana, he registers to vote. He stays in a hotel, in a hotel rental room in Indianapolis. He doesn't have property. He doesn't have a house. He doesn't have a voting address. He finally registers to vote on a family farm, but there's no he never lives there. And that's really the problem for Dick Lugar. I mean, he is one of the true thoughtful, conscientious, caring, non-soundbite, non-angry Republicans in the Senate, but that's not what the Tea Party wants. And both sides play this game. We've seen moderate Democrats getting thrown out in Pennsylvania a couple of weeks ago because they were too much of a centrist and they were too busy accommodating with Republicans. And Dick Lugar could pay the price as well. But, you know, he's 80 years old. He's been around a long time, seeking a seventh term. And there's some people say it's time for change. But the fact is, it's the Tea Party who's forcing him out. And if he loses, it'll be a sadder thing for the Republican Party because it'll be one more indication where the Tea Party wins and the Republican Party moves much further to the right, just as I argue that the Democratic Party is moving much further to the left since the 2010 election.
Is there a Democrat that can hold up against the Tea Party candidate?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, of course, theoretically, yes, and he's a good candidate, Joe Donnelly. He's a congressman from the 2nd District in Indiana. He's anti-abortion. He's pro-gun rights. He's anti-same-sex marriage. He's pretty conservative for a Democrat, but he barely won his reelection in 2010 in a very Republican year. But if the Republican Party is split and Richard Murdoch, who's the Republican running against Lugar, if Murdoch wins, the Democrats are hoping that the Lugar vote, the moderate Republican vote, will drift, either stay home or drift towards the Democrats. But again, Indiana is turning more and more red. Hmm. It's tougher for them to win it, and it's going to be a tough race. But Lugar will be a shoo-in if he wins the nomination. It'll be something to pay attention to if he loses, but I do think he loses the nomination.
Also on May 8th, the Wisconsin Democratic gubernatorial recall primary.
Yeah, that's
how does that work?
Well, I mean, Scott Walker is the Republican governor, the first ever Republican governor who's going to be recalled. I mean, there'll be a recall election for him on June 5th. But on Tuesday, there's going to be a four-way Democratic primary among two people, especially Tom Barrett, the mayor of Milwaukee, who is the overwhelming favorite for the nomination, and Kathleen Falk. She's the former county executive from Madison, Wisconsin. She's very liberal. The unions love her. But she's probably going to lose, and the unions are spending a lot of money in this recall. But so ultimately, I mean, Walker has $13 million in the bank. I mean, it's just unbelievable amount of money that he's raised in the last 3 months. Mm-hmm. But it's been very, very tight. I'll be honest with you. I am not a fan of recalls. I think you elect somebody unless it's, you know, ethical malfeasance or something, you know, just because you don't like what his or her policies are. You don't have a recall. I mean, just like saying that, well, I don't like the Obama health care bill. Let's recall him. You don't do that. I mean, that's what elections are for. They did this with Gray Davis in California in 2003. I thought it was wrong then, and I think it's wrong now. But you know, there's so much anger out there, and they, you know, just as the Republican Party is angry, the Democratic progressive wing of the party is angry as well, and they're certainly taking out. They're not happy with Kasich. We saw that with question five. Mm-hmm. Well, was it issue five,
issue
question
five,
two, whatever.
Issue two, yes, yeah. Senate Bill 5.
Yeah.
Right.
I just know it's from 1958. I know that.
Well, I wanted to get to the Washington primary and your note that just in case lame duck Representative Dennis Kucinich of Ohio is thinking about it, the filing deadline is May 18th. Filing deadline for what?
For if you want to run, there are three open congressional seats in Washington State.
And they still have a filing deadline.
Yeah, but because it's a September primary, so it's late in the process. And there are three open seats. One guy's running for governor, one's a new seat, and one guy's retiring. And of course, Kucinich has hinted, although he seems to have said that, no, I'm not going to do it. But those who want the continuation of Dennis Kucinich, and I believe all of America wants the continuation of Dennis Kucinich. One way to get it is perhaps him to run in Washington State. I don't think it's going to happen. And if he runs, I don't think he wins. But again, what else do I have to talk about? I mean, there's really nothing to talk about.
Well, Ken, thanks for talking to us about nothing today.
Thank you, Ann.
Thanks a lot. Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. Coming up, we're going to talk to the board member of the Ohio River Valley Council of Boy Scouts of America, who announced his resignation last week in support of the Ohio mother who was ousted as scout leader of her 7-year-old son's Boy Scouts troop because she's gay. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides begins, and it's the history of Persian culture and the current Iranian geopolitical situation. Join us for that discussion from 11 till noon on 89.7 NPR News. It's the Chefs in the City Baker's Dozen. You can bid now on 13 of the most sought-after Chefs in the City silent auction packages, even if you don't have a ticket to the event. Visit WOSU.org/chefs to view all 13 items up for bid, including a Greener Grocer weekly fresh market bag, a private 5-course dinner at Ella in New Albany, and much more. But hurry, bidding closes today at 1 p.m. Visit WOSU.org/chefs.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Noble on Long Condos, offering homeownership opportunities in the King Lincoln District featuring green design buildings within walking distance of local stores and restaurants. Details at homeportohio.org/noboonlong.
77 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today, a high of 87, partly cloudy tonight and a low of 64. A chance of showers on Friday, otherwise some sunshine, a high of 81 degrees. And then a chance of rain, maybe a thunderstorm Friday night, a low of 61. Looking ahead to the weekend, sunshine and a high of 78 for Saturday. This is 89.7 NPR News, and All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. Thanks for joining us.
On April 10th, Jennifer Terrell of Bridgeport, Ohio, was told she could no longer serve as den leader of her son's Cub Scout troop by the District Council of the Boy Scouts of America. She was forced to resign because she is a lesbian. In this CNN interview, Jennifer Terrell explains that she was aware of the official Boy Scout policy excluding gays from leadership positions within the organization.
I was aware of the policy and of the Supreme Court ruling from, I think it was 2000.
Right.
So being aware of those policies, I was hesitant to let Cruz even join the Scouts. But he was really excited about it, so I expressed my concerns to the local Cub Master, and he said there would be no problems, and there really hasn't been.
Since that time, Jennifer Terrell has gained support from parents of her local Boy Scout troop and from GLAAD, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation. Joining us now by phone from Wheeling, West Virginia, is David Sims. He was a board member of the Ohio River Valley Council. He resigned earlier this week to protest the removal of Jennifer Terrell as a Cub Scout leader because of her sexual orientation. David Sims is owner of the Sims Law Office and is an attorney in private practice in Wheeling. Welcome to the show, David Sims.
Thank you.
David, when did you become aware of the removal or the decision to remove Jennifer Terrell as a Cub Scout leader?
I became aware probably about a week ago. There was a letter, or I guess an email, really sent out to each of the board members for the Ohio River Valley Council describing what had happened and that gave us some information from the National Boy Scouts as to the policy. I had not heard of the incident and did some research on it, and I felt that the policy was wrong and that I really did not want to be part of the organization at that point if that was going to be the policy. So I tendered my resignation last Friday.
Why you decided to tender your resignation? Did you try to affect any change before you did that?
I did not, because this is a policy of the National Boy Scouts, mm-hmm. and not necessarily the policy of the local board, which is what I was a member of. The local board was merely carrying out what the national policy is. So I did not take any steps to try to change that national policy. It's been in effect for many, many years and is on the lead-in, as Jennifer said, it's a policy that's been upheld by the United States Supreme Court and one that the Boy Scouts, I think, have had probably since their inception.
Was it difficult for you? I know you have two college-age sons who participated in scouting.
Well, actually, I have one son who participated. Okay. And, you know, ultimately, this decision was not that difficult because it to me, it was, after I did a little research on it, it was a policy that I just thought was wrong and that fundamentally needs to be changed. So the decision to resign was really not that difficult.
Mike in the Short North, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Yeah, I just want to point out that it seems to me the Boy Scouts here, they try to pass themselves off as being this super American organization right up there with the American flag, motherhood, apple pie, all that stuff. I don't think they're any different than the country club that wants to discriminate against blacks, against women, against Jews. I don't think they deserve that position. They try to say, oh, well, we're protecting the boys and all that stuff. Give me a break. Are you telling me a lesbian woman is going to sexually abuse a boy? That's preposterous on the face of it. They just want the right to discriminate like any other racist organization.
Okay. Thank you, Mike. David Sims, you said, I believe you said in the article or in an article that you were unaware of the policy beforehand.
Yeah, I mean, I was vaguely aware and had a vague recollection of the court issue with regard to who could be a leader and who couldn't. It wasn't something I had gone and researched before I had agreed to join the board, and that's on me for not doing that. And it really didn't come fully to my attention until Ms. Terrell was removed. At that point, I started to do some research and educated myself a little bit more about what the policies were and you know, why this had happened. And at that point, I felt like, although I was a Boy Scout and my father and my grandfather before me, I did not want to be part of the leadership structure that was imposing these kinds of policies.
The director of public relations for the Boy Scouts of America issued the following statement to CNN. They said, "Scouting and the majority of parents it serves do not believe it is the right forum for children to become aware of the issue of sexual orientation or to engage in discussions about being gay. Such complex matters should be discussed with parents, caregivers, or spiritual advisors at the appropriate time and in the right setting. We fully understand and appreciate that not everyone will agree with any one policy or position." They really didn't bring up the issue about any kind of fear of safety for the kids.
No, and it's interesting now that they have taken this action that everybody's aware of it now, and probably including the kids. So I think that they probably brought more attention to it by taking this action than otherwise would have been brought to it.
Are you concerned about the questions that have been raised about possible other reasons or alleged other reasons for Jennifer Terrell's removal at the local level? In an interview, she said it was not until she began to question some financial improprieties when she became treasurer that the national policy was used against her.
I'm not aware of that part of it, so I really can't comment on that.
Are you satisfied with the Boy Scouts' response in this? Would you like to see them change the policy?
Absolutely. I'd like to see them re-examine the policy. Based upon the research I've done, I've found that, you know, the Girl Scouts do not have this policy. The Boys and Girls Clubs of America don't have the policy. 4-H does not have this policy. I think that the Boy Scouts National Board needs to take a look at the policy and look at really the reasons why they have the policy and reexamine it and maybe have a little more open mind. I think that in this day and age that maybe that this is a policy that needs to be changed and it's a little outdated.
We still have a few minutes if you want to talk about this issue about the Boy Scouts of America letting go a cub leader, who is lesbian. Because she's a lesbian, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Have you received any response from either the Boy Scouts of America or the council?
No, there have been a couple of people from the board who I have talked to about this. The National Boy Scouts has not contacted me, and generally the people I've talked to have supported my decision. I am an elected official here in this community, and that sort of plays into this decision too, because it's garnered a little more publicity than I thought it would. So generally, the people who I've talked to have supported my decision.
And have you received any negative feedback for it?
No one has sent anything to me directly that they have a negative opinion about it. I'm sure that there are people who disagree with it, but no one has said that to me.
I apologize. I didn't know you were a local elected public official. What is it that you were elected to?
I am a county commissioner here in Ohio County, West Virginia, and I've been in that capacity for the last 18 years.
Do you think this is something that could damage your role as a public official?
You know, it could. That's something that you know, I thought about, but it didn't factor into the decision because there's no way really to know. People, when you're in this position, people disagree with things you do and people agree with them. And I it was purely a personal decision on my part to do this, and I didn't factor in any political ramifications of it.
Rod in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yes, good morning. I wanted to preface my remark by saying that, you know, scouting teaches a lot of good things so far as that's concerned. Basically, I recall the incident of the Life Scout down in Charleston, West Virginia, who was denied Eagle Scout because he was an admitted agnostic. And it's my opinion that scouting needs to get caught up with the times here. You know, needs to get its act together. And also, you know, basically, as I understand, you know, scouting gets some of its funding from United Way and so forth. And I was wondering if there were any, you know, if someone did want to contribute to scouting as it is now, you know, what would they do?
Brian, that's a good question. I'm not sure that David Sims can answer that, though. David?
Well, I know that scouting does get some financial support from the United Way. I think most of the financial things that scouting does is there are a lot of fundraisers throughout the year, and, of course, there are dues to be part of scouting. There are various mechanisms for them to raise money. You know, I want to continue to support scouting because I think it's good for young people and certainly young men. And I was a part of it, and I benefited greatly from being a scout. And it's something I'd like to see more kids participate in. But I think that this kind of negative publicity doesn't help, and it's something that they need to reexamine and you know, make some decisions about where scouting's headed.
Okay. Thank you, Rod, for that call. I want to get to real quick to Adam in Columbus. You're on the air. Welcome to the show, Adam.
Yes, I'd like to just thank the scouts for taking a stand. Obviously, they have rules in place. This lady knew the rules when she took the job and knew that this would happen. It'd be the same thing if a girl wanted to join and got upset because they knew it was the Boy Scouts.
Are you frustrated that the local troop didn't assert the rules in the first place?
I think they should have. And obviously, if they were fine with her being a leader, fine. But at some point when the rules get enforced, they're going to have to be followed. And they should have done it initially and avoided the whole incident, I think.
Do you oppose ever changing those rules?
No, I think it is a quasi-public group, but it's not a public group. It's still private. They still can enforce their own rules. At that point, and if it were a public, say it was run through the public schools or something like that, sure, then the rules are different. But while it is still a private organization, they're allowed to have their own rules. That's what one of our freedoms is.
All right. Well, Adam, thanks for your call.
Sure. Thank
Take
you.
Care. Sue in Galena, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Sue.
Hi there. My son is working toward his Eagle Scout. My husband's very involved in our troop, and I'm just calling to thank Mr. Sims for taking his stance. I'm kind of the opposite of the previous caller. I just was really surprised when I got it. I think it was change.org has a survey going out of something that they're trying to gather signatures on. But I want to thank you for taking the stand, and I sure hope there are changes in the Scouts because it's a wonderful organization aside from this issue.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sue. You had just joined the board, right, David?
Yes, I actually was invited to join the board last fall, and first of the year became active on the board. So I had actually a short tenure. My father had been a member of the board for many years and had been involved in scouting his whole life, and he passed away 2 years ago. And that's sort of what led me to be asked to be on the board was sort of to follow his legacy in scouting, and I was happy to do that at the time. It was, as I said, I've been a supporter of scouting, and my father was very active in it, so it was something that I wanted to do and wanted to be part of.
Not to be maudlin, but how do you think he would have reacted to your decision?
You know, I think he would have supported my decision. At the end of the day, you know, he loves scouting and would never want to see anything happen to hurt scouting. But I know that he would have supported me because I think he would have felt that I did the right thing in this case.
Anita in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Anita.
Hi. I have a lot of Girl Scout cookies in my time, and my brother was a Boy Scout, and I support both organizations. I 100% turn away good leaders now when I believe what I've read is that they're having trouble finding, for some troops, parents.
Okay, Anita, bad phone call, but I get your point. It's hard to get leaders. Should they be using this as a way to screen them? Any sense about that, David Sims?
Well, I know that the numbers for scouting are down over the past several years, and I know that there's always a constant need for leaders and people who are willing to give their time. And in this case, obviously, Ms. Terrell was willing to do that, and I think it's unfortunate that someone that was willing to give her time and you know, support scouting was removed solely because of her sexual orientation. I mean, that was the only reason they removed her, and I think that that's very unfortunate and, again, a reason why they ought to reexamine their policies.
Well, David Sims, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
David Sims, he is an Ohio County Commissioner, a lawyer, and a former board member of the Ohio River Valley Council of Boy Scouts of America. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.